Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about someone who was one of the best known and influential scientists of his day. He was also a political theorist, and he was also a theologian. And he lived at a time when there really were no impediments to being all of those things at once, provided, of course, one had the abilities. The man we're talking about here is Joseph Priestley, and he is someone who not only is an important figure in the history of science, because he generally gets the credit for discovering oxygen, but also he has a particular place in the history of the United States, the early history of the United States. His ideas were very influential to the founders of the country. He was a friend of Thomas Jefferson. He also knew Ben Franklin and John Adams. And in fact, he lived the last 10 years of his life in the United States. Our guest this morning, Stephen Johnson, says that Priestley was central to the great minds of his period. His ideas connect him to epic changes in science, in belief, and society. But he says, our guest says, that Priestley is someone who has really unjustly been forgotten, particularly for his connections to the founders of the United States. You can read about all of this in a recently published book. The title is The Invention of Air, and the subtitle is A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America. Riverhead Books is the publisher. It's just recently out, and our guest this morning is the author, Stephen Johnson. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So, at any point here, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can do that. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is they just try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can keep moving along here in our program. But of course, anybody is welcome to call. And this morning, our guest is out on a tour. He's spending some time traveling around the country talking about the book, and he is, I believe, in Seattle this morning. Mr. Johnson, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
I am, in fact, in Seattle in my hotel room here.
Good. Oh, well, I appreciate you talking with us. I know it's a little earlier there than it is here.
I'm used to it already with this tour.
All right. Well, I'm glad to have the chance to talk with you, and also to have the chance to talk about Priestley, because here I am learning things about him that I didn't know, and certainly we should be introducing him, I think, probably to a lot of people who are listening.
Great, yeah. He's an amazing guy.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, one of the questions that you think about and write about in the book, and perhaps we can talk a little bit about it right up front, and then I'm sure it's something that we'll come back to, is when you look at someone like him who was influential in many ways, and even just within science, his ideas were very influential. You have to ask yourself this question: what was it about him? Or was there something about him as an individual that made that possible? Was it something about the time that he lived that made that possible?
Yeah, I think it has to be both. And in a way, that's one of the main preoccupations of the book. So, you know, I wanted to tell a story of this man's life and of the kind of his connection to the founders and his connection to American history. And I think it's a really great story. I mean, irrespective of what I do with it, it's just the facts of the story are really very interesting, I think. But I also wanted to do something else, which is to really try and wrestle with this question of why these men were so influential, why Priestley was so influential, why he was able to be as revolutionary in so many different fields. And I think part of the argument of the book is that to answer that question properly, you can't simply answer it on the kind of the scale of an individual person's life, his particular genius, his kind of the kind of local trajectory of his biography. It's partially that, but that's not all of it, and it's partially his kind of social setting and that particular moment in history. But it's also a number of different forces that come together. And so, you know, I talk a lot in the book about the kind of the information networks of the day. The Postal Service, for instance, was very important to his ability to kind of have these breakthrough ideas. The coffee house culture of the day, the amount of energy that was flowing through society during that period thanks to the Industrial Revolution that made all this possible. So there are all these different forces that kind of converge, and to tell it kind of accurately as a as a historian, I think you have to be able to tell it across those different scales, really.
And something else that here, you know, it gives one the opportunity to also to think about the kind of conflict, at least the conflict that some people see between science and religion, and reflect on the fact that there would have been a time, and the time that we're talking about is one of them, when many people didn't see that as being a conflict, and that in fact, with somebody like him, there was no particular reason why you could not be both a theologian and a person of faith, and also a scientist.
Yes, that is true. The only thing I would say to that is, I mean, certainly one of the important kind of values that I think that we should celebrate in these guys and try and, you know, revive in our own time is that they all had a kind of connective intelligence, that they were very learned in terms of science and you know, did amazing work in terms of political theory and building whole new political systems in the case of the founders, and also thought deeply and profoundly about religion, and they tried to build bridges between all those different things. On the other hand, Priestley became very controversial because he had his kind of empirical side partially forced him to really rewrite a lot of the assumptions that were built into Christianity. So he was a Christian to the very end, but he believed in what was at the time, and still really to this day, was a kind of an unusual vision of what that meant. He actually kind of co-founded the Unitarian Church in England, and he wrote a book called The History of the Corruptions of Christianity, and the idea was that while the kind of the original word of Christ and the original kind of core story of Christ's life was, you know, an immensely important one and one that one should kind of orient one's life around, and provided a kind of moral code that should be the core of one's life, he believed that story had been distorted by years and kind of centuries of kind of supernatural, kind of magical layers that have been added to the story by priests and theologians to kind of impress people. And so he believed you had to kind of strip away all of those things. He did not believe, for instance, in the divinity of Jesus Christ. He didn't believe in a Holy Ghost. He didn't believe in saints and relics and things like that. And so that, you know, that was not an easy, it wasn't as if there was a kind of an easy reconciliation to be made between his scientific kind of view of the world and his faith, but he did manage to do it. And that actually, one of the things that actually drew me into the story of Priestley's life first is that he had the single most profound impact on Jefferson's view of religion of anyone. I mean, Jefferson said he rested his kind of entire faith on Priestley's writings. And in some ways, he kept Jefferson a Christian. You know, Jefferson had wrestled with this whole life as well, and it wasn't until he read Priestley's book that he suddenly thought, aha, this is how I can kind of remain a kind of a man of science and the Enlightenment and yet still be attached to Christianity. This guy has kind of unlocked this puzzle for me.
And I mentioned just very briefly right at the beginning as I was trying to make a little introduction that he lived the last decade of his life, last 10 years he lived in the United States. And I think that was perhaps in large part because he literally, I think it's true to say, he was driven out of England.
And yeah, I mean, an old-fashioned angry mob, pitchforks and all, came to... He'd moved to Birmingham in the 1780s and had in some ways the happiest years of his life in Birmingham as part of, which was really the seat of the Industrial Revolution at that point. And he fell in with this great crowd called the Lunar Society, which is kind of intellectuals and rising kind of industrial magnates, Josiah Wedgwood and James Watt and so on. And they supported him. And they ended up supporting him in a way because they were both kind of wealthy and political radicals on their own. Priestley was kind of freed to write slightly more incendiary things than he'd been able to write before. And so he wrote both this book about Christianity, which, as you can imagine, was quite controversial at the time. And he had written a number of things supporting the American cause and the American Revolution. And then when the French Revolution came around, he was very supportive of that. And so by the end of that decade, the more, you know, kind of conservative forces in England really, you know, he'd become, you know, kind of public enemy number one for them, because he was tied in with the Industrial Revolution, which a lot of people were resisting, and because of these radical political beliefs and these radical religious beliefs. And so in 1791, a group of folks, including Priestley, decided to throw a little dinner party to celebrate the French Revolution on Bastille Day. And this may go down in history as the world's worst dinner party, where the word got out that these, you know, regicides were going to get together to toast, you know, the king's head on a platter. And so a group of folks decided to come out to protest it. And then Priestley ended up not going to this dinner party because he was worried about, you know, his safety. He stayed at home. But an angry mob actually showed up and, you know, kind of started pelting people with stones. And then they got kind of so excited that they went off and tore down two of the local dissenting churches in Birmingham. And then they set off for Priestley's house to kill him, to literally kill him. And he managed to escape, but they destroyed his house. They destroyed his lab, where he had kind of lovingly built for himself over the preceding years, and ended up burning down about 12 other houses in the area. And Priestley never really felt safe again. He tried to stay in England for a while, but it didn't work. So he emigrated to America in 1794.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Stephen Johnson. He's the author of a number of books, and his most recent is about Joseph Priestley. The title is The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America, and it's published by Riverhead Books. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. When Priestley started to get interested in, I guess, what then would have been called natural philosophy, what I suppose now we'd call science, he was, at the time, he was making his living as a writer, teacher. This, for him, I don't mean to trivialize it, but I suppose his interest in science at the time would have been something like a hobby, I guess. He started out, and you write in the book, like many of his peers, his first love was electricity. And certainly it was something that a lot of people, including Benjamin Franklin, were interested in. What was it that at that point for people like him was so interesting about electricity?
Well, it's this interesting convergence that you don't always see in the history of science, which is that you had pretty much at the same time you had, you know, really a fundamental breakthrough in our understanding of you know, a fundamental force in the world, you know, electricity. And at the same time you had really cool gadgets. So people would have these little electricity machines, and they would kind of wind them up in their parlors, you know, after dinner, as you know, kind of for fun, and they would give themselves shocks, and they would hold onto it and watch their hair stand on end and things like that. And so they'd captured this, you know, this force that until that point had been completely, you know, mystical to people. People had no idea what it was. People for a long time didn't realize that that's what lightning was until Franklin kind of figured it out. And so you had great science and kind of cool parlor tricks, basically, at one point. And so people just got really interested. And so, folks, one of the things I love, actually, it's the chapter, first main chapter of the book, is that the people who were researchers in this field, who were doing the important kind of science on electricity, were called the electricians. It's a term that now is slightly less impressive. But and Franklin, of course, had been, you know, this, you know, really the kind of leading scientist. And just like Priestley, he was also kind of an amateur. He was a dabbler in these things. And part of the point here is that there were no professionals, right? There wasn't a kind of department of, you know, physics or of electricity that you could go to be a tenured professor in. So if you were interested in these kinds of things, you had to just do it in your spare time.
Yeah, you talked about the importance of personal networks here, and the idea that people who were interested in different things and were doing experiments could get together and talk about what they were doing, share what they knew, and that way knowledge grows. And you talked about also the fact that the coffee house, you have an interesting, sort of as an interesting footnote here in the book, you note just how important coffee may well have been to the Enlightenment. If it wasn't for coffee, you know, maybe it wouldn't have happened, or wouldn't have happened when it did. So people got the opportunity to get together, exchange ideas, have a pleasant stimulant, and that was all very significant. How was it that in the midst of all that, that Priestley comes to meet Ben Franklin?
Well, he had this idea that it would be useful to write a book about the history of electricity. Up until that point, no one had kind of gathered together all these interesting innovations and cool technologies that had been associated with electricity over the preceding kind of 50 years. And so he had this idea that someone should write the book not just as a kind of a documentation of these discoveries, but they should write it as a story, as a story of progress, as a narrative of, you know, of the progress we've made over the preceding 50 years. And they should write it in a popular voice and an accessible voice. They should write it in English, which was, you know, a lot of scientific tracts during this period were written in Latin. So that alone was kind of an important step. And so he decided, he got an introduction to Franklin and a couple of his cronies in London. So he went into London and met with him. And one of the things he wanted, the thing that he really needed to do this, is he needed people's papers. He needed their own, you know, kind of published papers that they had and books that they had in their personal library, and he needed their correspondence. A lot of the kind of research in the day kind of spread through the information networks of the postal system. So Franklin would discover something, he would write his friend about it. He wouldn't publish it in a scholarly journal necessarily. And so it was very hard to get that data. There weren't really libraries you could go to. Obviously, there was no Google, and so he went to meet with those guys to ask if they would kind of turn over their libraries to him and advise him on this project. And he met them in the London Coffee House in the shadow of St. Paul's, where Franklin would meet with a group of kind of like-minded folks in the thing that he later called the Club of Honest Whigs, and they would have these great rambling sessions, drinking coffee and also a little booze, I think. And they would talk about everything. I mean, it was a great melting pot, intellectually speaking. For that period, they would talk about electricity and chemistry and religion and politics and all these different interests. And so that kind of node in the information network of the time, the coffee house, is really crucial to this. I mean, an incredibly kind of diverse number of things from this period come out of coffee house culture. Like the entire insurance industry is born in a coffee house called Lloyd's Coffee House, which became Lloyd's of London. So it's not incidental to the story that everybody was hanging out drinking coffee. There should be a plaque. The coffee house isn't there anymore. I went there a few months ago when I was in London, and there's a Starbucks there, but it's not quite the same.
Well, they're trying to keep it going there in a tiny franchised way.
I can tell you, it's been very good talking about the importance of coffee here in Seattle, where they're crazy about their coffee.
Wherever there's a coffee shop, I'm sure within stone's throw of any point standing on the street in Seattle. Let's go on and talk about oxygen, carbon dioxide. This is, if people know anything about anything at all, probably about Priestley, it is this idea that he discovered, and I guess maybe there's some question about whether he did or whether he was the only one, but that he discovered oxygen. And it's interesting to think about and to hear about how exactly this happened, because if you go back to a time when people were starting to try to think about how life worked, and they would have understood something like, well, if you take a living thing, you put it in a jar and you put a lid on it, you know, put a mouse in a jar and put a lid on it, the mouse is going to die. They weren't exactly sure why, but they knew that it would. Then they knew other sort of interesting things like, okay, after you've got your jar with a dead mouse in it, if you put a candle in it, it'll go out. And that also was very interesting. I thought, huh, okay, that's very interesting. And perhaps, I don't know if it in fact was Priestley, but, you know, if you get around to sticking a mouse in a jar with a plant and you screw the lid on, the mouse doesn't die. So yeah. All of this was food for thought in trying to figure out, well, exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting to remember about this period is, until really the century before Priestley, the whole question of what was in the air and how the air could change wasn't even understood as a problem that anyone would want to care about, right? I mean, if you looked around the world, you have this new tool of the scientific method, and you're like, what am I going to do with this new tool? You know, what am I going to look at? And you look around and you say, well, look, there's a human body. I think I probably could do some interesting tests on that. And there's a tree. I'd like to learn about trees. And there's a rock formation. I think there's something I could do with that. But the invisible space between all those things doesn't look like an object of study. There's nothing there to study, right? It's just empty. And it wasn't actually until that they invented the air pump that enabled you to take all the air out of a contained space and create a vacuum. And then you could prove in a vacuum that certain things demonstrably behaved differently. A candle wouldn't light in a vacuum, for instance. A bell wouldn't ring in a vacuum. That suddenly it became possible to say, oh, so there's this, if this is non-air, then air must be something. And we got to figure out what that something is. And so then air became kind of an object of study. And by Priestley's time, they started to realize that it was probably made up of different components. It wasn't just one thing. It was probably, there were multiple kind of gases that made it up. But that's all, I mean, there's very little that was understood about it. And as you say, you know, people had long known that if you sealed up a mouse in a jar, it would eventually die. They didn't understand whether the mouse was somehow poisoning the air or using it up in some fashion. In fact, the mouse was doing both, basically. It was using up all the oxygen and filling it with carbon dioxide. But it was still kind of just a complete mystery. And in fact, Priestley's brother has these memories of an 11-year-old Joseph Priestley trapping spiders in a jar and sitting and watching and waiting for them to die, which nowadays would probably get you put in some kind of special program at school for troubled youths. But back in the day, it was, I guess, a sign of budding genius. So Priestley had this kind of genius idea, which is, given all of that, he said, well, what would happen if you put a plant in a jar? How long is it going to take, you know, the plant to die if you cut off its air supply? So he goes into his backyard and he takes a little mint plant out of his garden and puts it in this vessel, kind of seals it up, and waits for it to die. And he comes back, you know, 2 weeks later, and it's not dead. In fact, it seems to be growing. So he thinks, well, that's weird. So he tries it with a couple of different plants, and it turns out, again and again, the plant survives. So then he has this really, really great, you know, kind of breakthrough idea, which is just very typical of his experimental method. He was just a great recombiner of things. So he decides to put a candle in the jar with the mint plant. And he seals it up, and then using a little burning lens, which would kind of concentrate the sun's rays on it, he lights the candle from outside. So the candle burns for a while, burns all the air out of the vessel, and then the candle gets extinguished because there's no oxygen left for it to burn. There's no combustion possible because there's no oxygen in there. And he knows at that point, if you had a mouse in there, the mouse would start to die immediately because there's no air to breathe, right? The mouse would be dead in 2 minutes. So he leaves that mint plant and this extinguished candle sealed up in this jar, and he goes away. And then 2 weeks later, he comes back, takes the burning lens, points it at the candle, and it lights. So somehow, in this space where there had been no air, 2 weeks later, there's air. Well, where did it come from? And so he starts to think, maybe it came from the plant. And so then he goes through his garden and finds lots of other plants and tries it, and it turns out, you know, one of the things he finds is that spinach generates the most air, which is good to know if you ever somewhere short of air, you want a spinach plant around. And so he gets confident enough that he's discovered something important, and so he writes a letter to one of the first people he writes to about it is Benjamin Franklin. And Franklin writes him back this beautiful letter, which I just think is just one of the great documents in the history of ideas. He writes back, and Franklin basically takes it to the next level. He says, you know, what you're describing there in that little jar is probably part of a much larger system. It's probably part of a rational system. That we know that all around the world, fire purifies water, and we know that, you know, manure can help plants to grow. It should make sense that nature has devised a scheme to purify the air, and that purification is coming from vegetable matter, you know, seems like a good plan. And so right there, he's grasping this fundamental truth about life on Earth that we now understand in great detail, which is that the whole reason we have an atmosphere to breathe is because it's been manufactured for us by the plants. The natural kind of state of oxygen on this Earth, our atmosphere would be less than 1% oxygen if there were no plants. And it's only because billions of years ago the plants hit upon this strategy of photosynthesis that happens to have this kind of waste product of oxygen that we now have an atmosphere that's very consistently 20.7% oxygen. And so we're entirely dependent on this kind of artificial bubble, this kind of life support system that's been created for us by the plants. And that is really one of the founding insights of kind of the ecosystem's view of the world, that we're bound up in this connected web with all these other life forms. And it was really Franklin and Priestley who first grasped that insight.
Yeah. And that seems like an incredibly profound idea and understanding, something that we maybe think of as being modern, and yet here, these men at this time, oh, well, actually, who were probably modern in a lot of ways, came to this notion that they may not have known precisely what it was, but that there was something that, one thing that animals needed to live, something else that plants needed to live, and that those two things were connected. There was this interesting reciprocal sort of relationship, which gets you to this idea that, that you know, it's not a huge step from there to start to think about the idea of the ecosystem, the fact that things are living, things are connected, and there's a certain balance that has to be established, and that if you take one thing out, it will disrupt everything.
Yeah, exactly right. In fact, in that letter, Franklin even begins, you know, kind of gets all the way to kind of an early version of kind of green politics, really, which is that he has a very funny line where he says, you know, I hope this discovery will temper the rage of late for chopping down all the trees near where people live because allegedly the trees make the air unwholesome. You know, in America, we have plenty of trees and we're a very, you know, hardy stock of people and we're never sick or something like that. Yeah. And so it's right there you see this idea. Not only are we in this connected web of you know, our ecosystems, but we have to be responsible stewards of that. And if we destroy too much of that system, there's going to be repercussions, and ultimately the whole system will get out of balance. Mm-hmm.
Just to sort of take a step back, that I think is kind of interesting and curious, is that maybe before, because coming to this understanding about oxygen, the thing that got his attention actually was carbon dioxide. And in fact, one of the things that he's credited with is, in a sense, is with the invention of carbonated water.
Yeah, this is just a classic Priestley story. It captures him in so many different ways. So he moves to Leeds because he gets a new gig as a minister. And so he moves his young family to Leeds, and this is just a little bit before the experiment we just talked about. And they're going to put him up in the minister's house at this church, but the minister's house isn't quite ready. So he moves into this kind of temporary setup. And it turns out this temporary house abuts a brewery. And so, you know, ever inquisitive, Priestley wanders over one day to inspect what's going on next door, and he notices that there's this interesting kind of haze coming off the all the beer that's brewing there. And so he goes over to the proprietors and he says, you know, would you mind if I did some science experiments here on top of your beer? Which I think is just, you know, you imagine the look on their face when the wacky minister from next door comes over and says, could I set up a little science lab right here, please? one of the things that he does is he discovers that if you pour water, ordinary water, back and forth over the brewing beer, you get, when you then drink it, it has this delightful kind of fizzy flavor to it. And so he's basically invented carbonated water. What I love about it is that he immediately just, you know, writes everybody about it. He writes a little pamphlet describing how to make it. He doesn't try and make a dime off it. He was a great believer in just the kind of the open flow of ideas, and, you know, that the whole point of discovering interesting things was to get them out to other people so that they could build on them and improve on them. And there wasn't a kind of proprietary bone in his body. And in fact, he wrote a long kind of argument to the Navy, saying that they should get soda water machines on their ships, because soda water would be useful in fighting scurvy. And in fact, he had a couple built so that they could take it off, and it turned out that was entirely wrong and had nothing to do with scurvy whatsoever. But that was like Priestley, to just kind of get, whether the ideas were right or wrong, to just get them out there so that people could figure out more. And in fact, a few years later, a certain Mr. Johann Jakob Schwepp patented his tonic water, and we're still paying the Schwepp's family every time we have a gin and tonic to this day. So the Priestley descendants probably regret it, but it was, that's just the way he was.
Yeah, it's a pity that Priestley hadn't thought about tossing a little lime juice in there with his carbonated water, and we would have had a refreshing beverage.
Exactly. Well, he did write to some of his friends. He said, you know, it's delightful if you put a little wine in it. And so I always thought it'd be funny if he just added a little bit more juice to the wine. He would have invented the wine cooler.
The wine cooler, yes. Among his great achievements on the list would be the invention of the wine cooler. We're a little bit past our midpoint here, maybe more than a little bit past our midpoint. Stephen Johnson is the guest. He's the author of a number of books, including The Ghost Map, Everything Bad is Good for You, and Mind Wide Open. And his most recent is about Priestley and about who he was, his work, his ideas, how influential they were, particularly here in early America. And the title of his book is The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America. The book is published by Riverhead. He's out now traveling around the country talking about the book. He's in Seattle today. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Did he, you talked about the fact that he never personally profited from the invention of soda water, as Mr. Schwepp later did. He took advantage of that. Did he, in fact, Priestley, from his scientific work, make money?
Not directly. I mean, it was very hard to... have a life as a professional scientist. So a big part of his story is the various different kind of schemes he had to support all the work that he did. And he was he was incredibly prolific. He wrote 500 books and pamphlets over the course of his life, in addition to all these other things that he did. I mean, somebody remarked after they read this book that, in addition to the ideas, that it left them with one overarching thought, which is, what have I done with my life? This guy is so productive. And so a big question is, how he's going to support himself. And he went through a number of different models over the course of his life, basically. I mean, he worked as a tutor early in his life and as a minister. And then he had a kind of aristocratic patron, Lord Shelburne, who actually had been and would be again prime minister, negotiated the end of the Revolutionary War, actually, but then in the 1780s, he, as we mentioned briefly, he fell in with the Lunar Society in Birmingham and was supported by this group of kind of early industrial magnates, basically, who were making all this money, building the first big factories and kind of inventing what industrial life was going to look like, and that's really crucial to the story, because that group of people were a very unusual thing in the history of ideas and particularly in capitalism, which is that they were both some of the wealthier people in the society were making all this money, and yet they were also political radicals who wanted to overthrow the system in some basic ways. And the reason for that is because the whole kind of urban explosion of Northern England that had been fueled by the Industrial Revolution. You had all these people moving to the cities like Birmingham and like Manchester. Those cities just grew at an extraordinary rate. They kind of tripled in size over the course of a couple of generations. And yet the makeup of Parliament didn't change. So Birmingham didn't have a representative, even though it was one of the largest cities in England. It didn't have a representative in Parliament. Manchester didn't have a representative, I think, until the 1850s. And so the reason the Industrial Revolution happened there is because there was all this stored energy trapped in these coal deposits that happened to be just kind of very close to the surface in Northern England. And yet the map of Parliament was still mapped on kind of the energy supply of England circa 1200 AD, right? And so you had this kind of disconnect between where all the money was being made and where, in a sense, the future of the country was headed and where the political representation was. So the folks who were making all this money in Northern England were very much interested in major political reform and wanted things to change, even though they were also very wealthy. Normally the most wealthy sections of society tend to be the most conservative. They don't want anything to change because things are going well for them. And so with these supporters, Priestley was then kind of encouraged and kind of enabled or liberated and allowed to write pretty much anything he wanted. And so his writing got more kind of open and more controversial, and it was that newfound controversy that eventually led that angry mob to come to his house and drive him to America. Mm.
Well, so it sounds as if it almost was. We've talked about how you could see some of his ideas about science being revolutionary. You could certainly see his approach to religion and faith. We talked earlier about the fact that he was one of the people who was involved in founding the Unitarian movement. So and had things to say about a religion that people would have thought would be at at the very least would be a revolutionary, and at the worst might be heretical. So perhaps it's not surprising that also he would apply that same kind of approach to thinking about how society was organized and politics, would help to explain why it was that he seemed to be a very somebody who really believed in the idea of political dissent and defending people who were political dissenters.
Yeah, I mean, one of the key organizing principles that shows up in all those different fields, that's kind of this pattern that appears in everything that he writes about, is just this belief in the free flow of information. He believed in that in terms of science. He believed that the whole point of having good ideas was to share them so that other people could improve them. And he believed that if you liberated your ideas and let them kind of float through society, they would get improved upon, and then ultimately, reason would win out and more understanding would spread through the society. And he believed that that was the case with politics and with religion as well. He believed that, society should tolerate all sorts of different religious views and that people should get together and discuss them. And he believed over time that would lead to more clarity and more understanding and not more kind of fighting. And so he didn't believe in, state religions. He didn't believe in all these things. And that, it's the same thing with kind of political views. He wanted to have an open marketplace of ideas. There were certain factions in the society that just weren't ready for those concepts, most of which we now, I think, for the most part, accept in this country.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit more than 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just let me very quickly again introduce the guest, Stephen Johnson. His book, if you'd like to read it, is The Invention of Air. It's all about Joseph Priestley. The publisher on the book is Riverhead. It's out now. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit about how it is that Priestley met Benjamin Franklin in London. We talked a little bit about the influence that Priestley's ideas about religion had on Thomas Jefferson and his ideas about religion. Can you talk some more about his involvement with men like that, people who were responsible for the founding of the country?
Well, when he comes over in 1794, that alone is really a milestone for our country, in that he kind of inaugurates one of the great traditions that we have here, which is he was our first great scientist exile. Coming to the shores of the United States with the promise of kind of intellectual freedom that the country is offering, and Einstein and many others kind of followed in his footsteps. And when he arrives here, he's kind of greeted as a hero. He has tea with Washington a couple of times, and he's very close with John Adams, who he had met in London in the 1780s. And Jefferson writes him a number of kind of fan letters from Monticello, and so it's all going very well. And then during the Adams administration, he gets kind of embroiled in controversy. His whole idea was he was going to move to America and not be in any more controversies and, no more angry mobs, no more fights with the government, all this stuff. But it doesn't really work out that way. And during the Adams administration, when the whole kind of falling out between Adams and Jefferson happens over France and other things, Priestley basically sides with Jefferson and writes a few pamphlets basically being critical of the Adams administration. And he has a colleague, Thomas Cooper, who he was very close to, who wrote even more intense things. And so when the Alien and Sedition Acts get passed, Priestley actually gets put on the hit list. And Adams is advised that Priestley should be deported. He's not a citizen. And he's been critical of the government, and this is exactly why we passed these acts. During wartime, we should be able to deport people who are critical of our government, who aren't citizens, and we should be able to arrest people who are. And so Cooper is actually arrested. And Adams faces this really extraordinary personal and historic decision with Priestley, which is, is he going to arrest and deport his old friend, who's kind of betrayed him, or on a larger scale, how is this young country going to deal with its intellectual dissidents? Are they going to get arrested and thrown out of the country, or are they going to be allowed to write their pamphlets in peace? And so Adams, actually, at this momentous kind of turning point, though he was notoriously thin-skinned, he kind of blinks and lets Priestley off the hook. And so Priestley kind of dodges that bullet, but right there, there's, it's just an amazing point that he shows up in. And then Jefferson gets elected president in 1801, and one of the first things he does is he writes this amazing letter to Priestley, kind of a fan letter. but it's also a kind of vicious attack on the Adams administration. He basically apologizes, even though he had been vice president during it. He apologizes for all the abuses and the, kind of the madness of the last 4 years, and he tells Priestley that he's at the very pinnacle of achievement and that the country has been so honored by his coming there, and that it gives him great pleasure as president, as one of his first acts, to welcome him and offer the protection of the country's laws and all that kind of stuff. It's a very moving, kind of stirring letter. And then ultimately, that letter, years later, years after Priestley dies, that letter gets published in London in a kind of random book, and that book finds its way back to Quincy, Massachusetts in 1812, where John Adams reads it for the first time. And Adams has just recently gotten into his correspondence with Jefferson, and Adams reads his letter where basically Jefferson is talking all this trash about him and criticizing his administration and all this stuff and being so condescending about Adams. So he's infuriated, and he writes this long letter back to Jefferson and writes a number of letters talking about this letter. And it's really that letter that sparks the great Adams-Jefferson correspondence. Mm-hmm. It's after Priestley, this letter from Priestley or to Priestley is uncovered, that they really start having this great American conversation about what the Revolution meant, the role of religion in society, the role of science and progress in the American experiment, all this kind of stuff. And so Priestley had been dead for 8 years, and he's still animating this crucial conversation in our history.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things that I think you mentioned in here is that in reference to this very famous correspondence between Adams and Jefferson, that if you read it, you actually see that Priestley's name comes up more than Washington, Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, all these men who were the key players in this, that actually Priestley warrants more mentions than these other guys do.
By far, Priestley's mentioned in that post-1812 correspondence, he's mentioned 52 times. And Hamilton, Washington, and Franklin are together mentioned, I think, less than 10 times. So you get the magnitude of the impact that this guy had on these men. And I think, one of the things I wanted to do with this book is to, when you look at the founders through this kind of outsider's view, through the view of this British guy, I mean, it's an odd story of kind of collaboration between Brits and Americans at this time, when that was so much about the conflict. But when you look at their lives, kind of through Priestley's life, what you really get is, I think, a really strong reminder of how integrated science was into their worldview, and how intellectually diverse they were in their interests. And I just wanted that to be a reminder when we think about, why we revere the Founding Fathers and what we look to and why we want to emulate them, and when we talk about the founding values of this country, like, what are we talking about? And I think it's important to remember that one of those founding values was this wide-ranging kind of intellectual interest and the belief that you had to be learned in science to be a thinking person. Because, the fact of the matter is that, science is far more important to contemporary society now than it was back then. I mean, think of the issues that are so essential to our time, whether they're energy issues and environmental issues and genomics and stem cell research and the impact of the internet in terms of computer science. So many things are being shaped or that require the understandings of science to make sense of. And so when we elect leaders who don't seem to care about these things or don't profess to have any real kind of knowledge about them, it's not like we have to elect scientists to be our leaders, but we at least want to have people who are, kind of wide-ranging intellects on some level.
Yeah.
Because those are our roots. That's the intellectual kind of foundation of this country, and I don't think we want to venture too far from that.
Well, it strikes me that takes me right back to the note you have right at the very beginning of the book,
mm-hmm.
where you talk about the fact that around the time that you started to write it, you write here, a leading candidate for the presidency of the United States was asked on national television whether he believed in the theory of evolution, and he shrugged off the question with a dismissive jab of humor. As you write, it's interesting the question would even be asked of someone running for president. He said, I'm not planning on writing the curriculum for an eighth grade science book. I'm asking for the opportunity to be president of the United States. And you went on to make the observation, well, that line will get a laugh. And yet you say, well, wait a minute. What's wrong with asking a question like that? And why should it be thought strange, or maybe it's wrong that it be thought strange that the president of the United States would be interested in science. That's perfectly appropriate, and maybe that's really is necessary that the president be interested in science.
For the joke to make sense, you have to believe that science is this thing that's just for the guys in the lab coats, mm-hmm. and that it would never make sense if the question had been about foreign policy and the joke was, I just want to be president. I'm not writing a international affairs textbook. Come on, why are you asking me about foreign policy? But for some reason with science, we assume, that's not something you need to know anything about. And that's just not only irresponsible and anti-intellectual, but like in the context of this story and what we know about the founders, I think it's kind of un-American, right? And we should keep that in mind when we decide who we're choosing. And I feel, I think it's an interesting optimistic sign that, for instance, we're going to have a Nobel laureate as our energy secretary. I mean, it's not that, our leaders have to be scientists. It's just that they should, have that kind of, they should welcome that kind of expertise and be at least somewhat fluent in it. It's harder to be a polymath today because we have so much knowledge and there's so much, complexity to science now. But that's okay. We should try. We should set the bar high for ourselves and particularly for our leaders.
And something else that this points at, and that is that what you think about how science developed at some point, as science develops more and more, as the body of knowledge grows, then you find increasing kind of specialization to the point where there would have been a point not all that long ago where you'd say you look at a university campus where everybody's in their own building, everybody's doing their own thing, they're doing their own research, and not only is there not any sort of cross-fertilization, not only are the physicists not sitting down with the English professors, but, the physicists aren't sitting down with the chemists either, and that this is something that has been changing for some time, but it still seems that there still has to be this deliberate sort of effort to get people from either different disciplines or even within science, people who do different kinds of work, create opportunities for those people to come together, talk to each other, talk about what they're doing, share ideas, because that can be a very important source for an engine for innovation when people start getting together and talking about things. And that's exactly the kind of thing that happened at the coffee house where Franklin and Priestley and these other people sat down and were sitting around having coffee and talking about what they were interested in.
It may sound unlikely in the age of Starbucks, but I think we need more coffee houses.
We need more independently, locally owned coffee houses.
Exactly.
Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have maybe a minute or so left, and we've really skated over what was a very interesting life and the man who did all kinds of things. A way to end was actually with one of those sort of beginning questions that I'm sure people ask you was, well, why did you get interested in writing about this guy in the first place?
I was really going to write another book. Actually, I'm going to now turn to writing this book, but I was going to write a more general book about ideas and innovation that wasn't going to have a single kind of narrative. It was going to have a bunch of different anecdotes. And I was interested in this question of ecosystems and whether you could use the ecosystem as a metaphor for how information flows through society. And so I started to do research on kind of ecosystem science, which is a very cross-disciplinary science, actually. It's one of the encouraging things here in terms of thinking across borders like that. And I came across this story about Priestley, and the more I read about him, the more I realized he had this American connection. One day I said, actually, this is the book. I'm going to write this book first because this is a great story and more people need to know about it, and it's going to be relevant in the political context. And so I managed to convince my editors that a book about 18th century chemistry was going to spark a good conversation, and thus far it seems to be working out.
Yeah, well, I certainly think so. So as you're traveling around, you're finding out people are actually saying, well, this is, I didn't know this. I'm happy to know this. And it is indeed really fascinating in so many different ways.
Yeah, it's been a great experience. The tour has been really fun, and it's been a great honor to see people getting energized by something that at the face of it might seem a little bit obscure. So So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess at that point we can say to people, if you would like to read this story, the book to look for is The Invention of Air, a story of science, faith, revolution, and the birth of America. That's the subtitle. It's published by Riverhead Books by our guest Stephen Johnson, also the author of a number of other books, including The Ghost Map, Everything Bad is Good for You, and The Mind Wide Open. He makes his home in Brooklyn, but right at the moment he's traveling around the country to talk about the book. He's in Seattle today. And Mr. Johnson, well, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed it.